wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. John Nelson produced today's program. We at the Old Mole are dedicated to offering a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and LGBTQ-positive analysis of culture, politics, and current events. On our program today, Luisa Martinez interviews Cuban journalist and filmmaker Daniel Montero about his documentary film War on Cuba, which is about the U.S.-Cuban blockade that has been blowing hot and cold, but never stopping, since at least the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Homicide, suicide, infanticide, ecocide, all these words obviously share a common root, but one of them is different from the others. Ecocide, obviously the wanton destruction of the environment by humans, has no legal standing before a court of law. You cannot be charged with committing it. There's a campaign underway to change that. Our Weapon the Law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, are here to discuss this movement, seeking to really pursue major polluters and destroyers of the planet. U.S. investor-owned utilities, including PG&E and Pacific Power, were informed by their researchers and independent scientists as early as 1968 that burning fossil fuels could generate a global warming disaster. The utilities cooperated with their fossil fuel industry partners to suppress this research and indeed contributed to climate change denial propaganda efforts. And as an alternative solar and wind energy developed and became advantageous to homeowners, the utilities used their billions for political contributions and lobbyists to enact laws and gain public utility commission rulings to stifle the building out of local sun and wind energy. PG&E and Pacific Power were particularly influential, such that Oregon is well behind California and Washington in alternative energy development. Bill Resnick leads off today talking with Dave Anderson, the policy and communications manager for the Energy and Policy Institute that uncovered much of this history. Bill?
Hi, Dave Anderson. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, great to be here. Happy to talk to you and your listeners.
Dave Anderson is the policy and communications manager for the Energy and Policy Institute. The Institute is a watchdog research group that counters misinformation, not just from the fossil fuel industry, also from the investor-owned utilities like PGE and Pacific Power in Oregon. It exposes their attacks on renewable energy, and especially when local communities and people try to build out rooftop solar or sun and wind farms, any source of power not under their control and giving them profits. The investor-owned utilities, the IOUs, try to destroy that. Later today, we'll be discussing that, the IOU's ongoing efforts to stifle the development of community energy across the country later in the interview. And we'll end with the good news that they have not been very successful, at least in some cities and states, unfortunately not Oregon. First, though, Dave Anderson, the tobacco companies knew that cigarettes cause cancer. They not just suppressed that information, but created their own fake facts. We also know the fossil fuel industry knew that burning coal and oil caused climate change and then funded campaigns of climate change denial. And now we've learned, because of research from your Energy and Policy Institute, it exposed that the investor-owned utilities had even earlier knowledge that burning coal was dangerous, and they carried out their campaigns of disinformation. Tell us the story.
Absolutely. So along with my colleagues at the Energy and Policy Institute, we wrote a report looking into the utility industry's own documents about climate change, going as far back as the 1960s, and found that as far back as around 1968, the industry was being warned by top scientists about the possible risks of burning fossil fuels might pose to the climate one day. Things that they were warned about was the possibility of ice melting in the Arctic and sea level rise, and in more recent decades, even about climate change fueling stronger storms and, you know, essentially destroying all sorts of utility infrastructure and, of course, wreaking havoc on coastal towns and communities in the southern part of this country. Basically, they took a long look over many decades and found that between the 1960s and mid-1980s, the utility industry actually funded and received a lot of research about climate change that was accurate in terms of the warnings and information they were receiving about the possibility of climate change from burning fossil fuels. But then once the Congress and really the global community turned the page to trying to take action to limit the burning of fossil fuels and emissions of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, the utility industry kind of freaked out around 1988 and started funding climate denial campaigns, basically to sow doubt about the very science that they themselves had known about and helped to fund prior to that. And that continued in different forms up until present day, when we can see big utility companies like American Electric Power pulling the strings behind the scenes to oppose the inclusion of strong clean energy and climate bills in legislation that's now before Congress.
Yeah, Dave, the people in countries around the world are suffering great droughts and storms, people in the U.S. as well. Island peoples are seeing their lands disappearing under the waves. In Pakistan and India, they're experiencing long periods of temperatures over 120 degrees. Humans cannot live for long in that heat. Have any of the IOUs apologized and more important, sent some of their profits to those people? It seems to me that the number of deaths from climate change now is greatly rising and into the millions and millions, with more to come. I know there have been suits against the fossil fuel industry, claiming that they were, well, efforts to get the fossil fuel industry prosecuted, and suits by cities in the United States claiming damages against the fossil fuel industry. Those are really alive and frightening, the fossil fuel people. Are the IOUs also being threatened in that way, that they were part of the apparatus that has tried to stifle what they knew?
Yeah, some utility companies were included in a few of the earliest lawsuits aimed at basically addressing damages caused by climate change to local communities in U.S. courts. And more recently, as you noted, those cases have focused on a key set of some of the top producers of carbon-based fuels like ExxonMobil and coal companies like Peabody Energy. But many legal analysts expect that utilities will be pulled back into lawsuits like that in the near future, and some investor-owned utilities actually disclose that as a likely risk when they're reporting to their own investors on an annual and like quarterly basis. So to answer your question more directly, they have not been required to pay any money to cover the damages that their emissions have caused over the decades.
I suppose the International Criminal Court is not going to take up jurisdiction against those people in fine Armani suits. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, our old mole variety hour. The variety is about malfeasance from above and struggle from below. I'm talking today to Dave Anderson, the Policy and Communications Manager for the Energy and Policy Institute. It's a research group that counters misinformation, not just from the fossil fuel industry, also the investor-owned utilities like PGE and Pacific Power here in Oregon. We just discussed how the IOUs contributed to campaigns of climate change denial and are now being sued. So not only did they deceive about fossil fuel burning and renewable energy, they have also, the IOUs of the country, including, of course, the slick operators of PGE and Pacific Power in Oregon, they've worked hard to stifle the development of local sun and wind energy. I know you've done research on that as well. Tell us how they're doing it.
Yes, that's definitely the case. So a lot of this occurs through campaigns run by the industry group that represents investor-owned utilities, which is called the Edison Electric Institute. And a few years ago, the Energy and Policy Institute, my group, obtained documents from that industry association essentially laying out their campaign to stifle the growth of competition from rooftop solar that was facing their member utility companies. Essentially, the utilities are fearful of distributed renewable energy growing, people being able to buy and install their own solar panels and then sell extra electricity that they generate back to the grid to benefit others. So the utilities launched a massive campaign against that, often working hand in hand with other nonprofits that utilities fund, but that you might not guess would be funded by a utility, to try to make the case that this was in fact like a consumer-driven campaign and not in fact utilities pushing to roll back policies like net metering that have driven the growth of rooftop solar around the country.
Yeah, they've done it in a number of ways, through legislation and through Public Utility Commission decisions. I think one way is that they become the gatekeepers, or that people who, that is, you cannot be paid, you can put up solar panels, but they can refuse to pay you for the excess that comes in. And indeed, they may charge you large fees for being connected to the grid, even if you only use grid power for a couple days in the year. That's been
absolutely
been successful in some legislatures, I think, but not all of them.
Yeah, that's correct. And probably one of the craziest things about this story is that the Edison Electric Institute and electric utilities have essentially gone from state to state and argued net metering, while it benefits those who install rooftop panels on their homes, it creates a cost shift where others have to pay for those costs of those things. And therefore, you know, the people who sell electricity back from their solar panels should be paid less or nothing for that power. So the flip side of that is that the Edison Electric Institute itself is actually funded via a meter cost shift that should be borne by utility shareholders, but is largely passed on to ratepayers through their electricity bills in all of the states. This is a group that brings in tens of millions of dollars each year and pays tons of money to its own executives and lobbyists to do this kind of work around the country. So there's a lot of fights in different states now to ensure that utilities can use less or none of the money they get from ratepayers to fund this group. As the question of the net metering cost shift and rooftop solar, there have been studies by like the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that found the opposite, that in fact net metering from rooftop solar is cheaper than utilities spending tons of money building out new gas and fossil fuel infrastructure, or, you know, massive amounts of transmission lines. So I think one of the reasons why they failed in a lot of places is that when state regulators and legislators took a look under the hood of these utility companies, it was like, well, there's certainly no end to things that you waste ratepayer money on that we could look at, but these net metering programs don't seem to be one of these things. If anything, the benefits that they provide in terms of new jobs and saving us money elsewhere on the production of electricity seem to far outweigh the very small costs that might be passed on to other ratepayers.
Yeah, they get away with that argument. They have succeeded with that bogus argument that it's going to cost people without solar panels on the roof, that it's going to increase their utility bill. They succeeded with that partly because the Cub actually also bought the argument, and the newspapers. You know, they also say that, I mean, they manufacture reasons. I think one of the comic ones that I've read about, they say wind turbines, they kill birds. And they're all trying to get all bird lovers on their side. I've read that for every bird that's killed by a wind turbine, 1,000 birds are killed by house cats.
Yeah, I think if you think about it too, and scientific research has found this, that fossil fuel power, of course, also impacts wildlife on a far more dramatic scale. For example, in the Great Lakes, one of the largest sources of mercury pollution that affects fish and birds and other wildlife is from coal-fired power plants that are run by electric utilities and fossil fuel companies. So often the special interest groups that are popping up and saying, oh, you know, solar panel, it's just a giant mirror that's going to shine light in your eye when you drive by, or birds are going to run into a wind turbine, are the same ones that are trying to deny the science that shows the harmful impacts of burning fossil fuels on our planet and climate. So you can kind of see the hypocrisy there, and they're making the arguments that they're getting paid to make by these big companies.
Yeah, we mentioned it before. They've become quite sophisticated, or they have been, the investor-owned utilities. They have vast amounts of money. And not only them, of course, the financiers are also in the game, and the underwriters and the people who buy and sell their stocks. The investor-owned utilities are guaranteed a high rate of return, and they in turn provide high rates of return on dividends for the rentier class, for the people who own stock and bonds. It's a major, it's like the power supply, which is absolutely necessary for a modern economy, for our communications, for our hospitals, for our transportation. Every time we use any of these services or, in fact, take any action or even buy food, the power companies get their share of some share, small, but when you add them all up, enormous from us. But they're very clever, the investor-owned utilities. They have charitable foundations. In Oregon, the charitable foundation gives to inner-city programs, church programs, all sorts of, even other environmental programs, like the Audubon Society. How do we counter that?
Well, I think one case study might be found in the state of Ohio, where certainly utilities like First Energy have a long history of paying money to charities, unfortunately, and then going back to those same charities when they have a rate case or they want, you know, the state to bail out their uncompetitive and ancient coal plants, for example. They go back to those same charities and ask them to support the position that they're advocating for, essentially. But utilities have gone even beyond that and started to fund different types of nonprofits, some of them called 501c4s, which essentially don't have to disclose their donors to the IRS. Therefore, it's very hard to trace the money trails between companies to these groups. And in Ohio, we were fortunately able to find one $2 million payment that a bankrupt First Energy subsidiary had made and had to disclose in a bankruptcy court filing to a dark money group that ended up just being the tip of the iceberg of a $60 million bribery scandal that's now been investigated by the FBI and U.S. Department of Justice. And they found that First Energy paid money not only to the former Speaker of the Ohio House, but also the chairman of the Public Utilities Commission there that's supposed to represent ratepayers in exchange for all sorts of financially beneficial favors. So I guess one way to stop utilities from doing these things is just to investigate them thoroughly and, you know, when possible, be able to make sure that law enforcement officials and regulators who are in a position to power to do something are in a position to use the information that researchers and advocates find and make it public.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, on our Old Mole Variety Hour, talking today to Dave Anderson, the Policy and Communications Manager for the Energy and Policy Institute. Dave Anderson, the IOUs and their friends, including we had not yet, in fact, discussed the role of the Koch brothers, a big fossil fuel conglomerate, and their American Legislative Exchange Council that has passed laws in many states that terribly disadvantage local community energy and renewable sun and wind programs. We're not going to have time for that. But the IOUs and the Koch brothers and the financiers, it's quite a rogues gallery of predatory interests. They haven't always been successful. In fact, in quite a few cities and states and also many organizations, including many of the biggest climate action groups, are supporting the build-out of local energy with local control and local jobs. And those utilities also can build crusades for energy conservation and use reduction, which enormously reduces the overall social cost of replacing fossil fuels. If you don't use as much energy, you don't have to build as many wind installations or put up solar panels. Tell us about our successes and possibilities.
Sure. Well, I think that given the ability of these massive companies to block action on climate change and clean energy and energy efficiency at the federal level in D.C., we have seen a lot of states and cities and communities rally more around localized action, and part of that's been requiring utilities to invest more of their own money in renewables and efficiency. But the other part of it is also just providing more support for programs that bring that clean energy to consumers and help them save money. And I think part of the reason that this stuff has been so successful in more recent years is that we've really moved beyond the point where any credible argument can be made that fossil fuels are somehow cheaper than renewable energy and energy efficiency. And the technology that allows us to use less energy or produce it cleaner has just become so cost competitive or even cheaper than fossil fuels that those arguments are falling by the wayside, and states and local communities that are smart are choosing to invest their money in the stuff that pays them back multiple times over and helps our environment and creates jobs and all that good stuff.
You know, in California, I understand, In fact, I'm sure there are mandates now, legislative passed mandates to put solar on all new residential construction, except in the most shady areas. Dave Anderson, policy and communications manager for the Energy and Policy Institute, keep up the good work. I recommend that people go to their website, Energy and Policy Institute, read their reports. Many of them they're very accessible. They cite longer reports in their research. They're very good reading. Dave Anderson, thanks a lot, and keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm a guy with a heart of gold, the ways of a gentleman. I've been told the kind of guy who would never harm a flea. But if me and a certain character met the man who invented the cigarette, I'd murder that son of a gun in the first degree. Now it ain't cause I don't smoke myself, and I don't figure it'll hurt my health. I've been smoking for 25 years, ain't dead yet. But them nicotine slaves, they're all the same. At a petting party or a poker game, everything's gotta stop while you smoke that cigarette. Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you just hate to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette. Had a game of chance the other night. Old Dame Fortune was doing me right. Kings and queens just kept on coming round. But I played him low, bet him high. My blood didn't work on a certain guy. Kept on betting, laying that money down. He'd raise me, I'd raise him. I sweated blood, you gotta sink or swim. We finally called and then didn't raise the bet. I said, aces, full pal, how about you? He said, I'll tell you in a minute or two, but right now I'm gonna smoke another cigarette.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you puff yourself to death.
Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you just hate to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette. Smoke?
I couldn't find a song as catchy as that one, but that was about big oil, such as burn, burn, burn those fossil fuels, burn, burn, burn until you burn us all to death. But the analogy between the mendacity of big oil and big tobacco is well documented. There are many, many versions of this song. That was by Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. The commander himself, George Frayne, died just a little more than a week ago on September 26, at the age of 77. I can remember in the late 60s the band would play for free most Sunday afternoons on Sproul Plaza on the UC Berkeley campus and pass around gallon jugs of Red Mountain wine. Up next, Lucia Martinez interviews Daniel Montero, journalist and filmmaker of the documentary series The War on Cuba. The series focuses on the devastating impact of the generations-long illegal U.S. economic war on Cuba. Montero is also part of a media outlet titled Belly of the Beast, investigative journalism that exposes the political and economic interests driving U.S. policy and its impact on Cubans, home and abroad. Luisa interviewed Daniel, who is in Cuba, through the Zoom telecommunications platform, which is subject to a legal U.S. sanction, and was operated through a virtual private network, or VPN. This resulted in at times poor audio quality. Special thanks to Patricia Kohlberg for rescuing parts of this discussion.
Hey there, Olmos. This is Luisa Martinez coming to you with another international piece. Today I have the pleasure of talking with Daniel Montero. He is a journalist and producer with Belly of the Beast. Daniel has been interviewed on Democracy Now! And has published in The Guardian. And he graduated from the University of Havana's Communications School in 2020 with a degree in journalism. And yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for talking to me from Cuba. So my first question is that back in July, U.S. media covered extensively anti-government protests called SOS Cuba. Can you give some context to these protests and what role the U.S. government played in them?
Yes, of course. Back in July 11th, the biggest anti-government protests in decades happened here in Cuba. They lasted a day and a half here, thousands took to the streets. And even though a lot of what people were talking about had to do with, I don't know, political messages, I can tell you that the main causes of this protest had to do with the major crisis that we have going on in the country for quite some time now. Scarcities of food, I would say, from two major reasons. And this goes to answer what the United States' role in all of this is. And it is the fact that COVID has really hit hard Cuba, because, for instance, tourism plays a big role in our economy. And the other reason, of course, is the United States sanctions. During the Trump administration, more than 200 new sanctions were imposed on Cuba, adding to the already existing one because of a 60-year-old policy of war, basically an economic war being waged against Cuba. And that's basically the role that the United States plays in all of this.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about Biden's response to the SOSQ protests?
After the protest, the Biden administration has focused on three main things when it comes to the protest. One has been giving us internet. Two has been giving us vaccines to against COVID. And three has been bringing remittances to Cuba without them going through government. Now, the thing is that all of these three things we already have. Cuba has produced five of its own vaccines, and right now the majority of the country extensively has already received at least one doses of the vaccine. Internet, we already have, obviously, since I'm talking to you via internet. And number three, remittances are already coming into Cuba by the millions through unofficial ways. So that's basically what the Biden administration has focused on, when what they should have been focusing on is withdrawing from a policy of aggression that they have against Cuba for 60 years now, and that the Biden administration has done nothing against. The major thing that United States politicians could do to help the Cuban people would be to stop the blockade, the embargo. But that's not what they have chosen to do.
And can you just give an example of how the blockade affects everyday Cuban life?
First of all, the blockade is an economic war. It basically prevents the Cuban government from doing business with the United States and with many other governments because it's extraterritorial. Now, the number one thing is that governments provide services. And in the case of the Cuban government, those services are quite large. We're talking about medicine. We're talking about education. So when you prevent that government from functioning normally, you are affecting the people that are the beneficiaries of those services. That's one side of it. The other side of it is that many of these sanctions are specific enough so you can feel it directly. We're talking about cutting down on remittances. Thousands and hundreds of thousands of Cubans have relatives in America that are now almost unable to send money to Cuba, or they have to do it paying more money to do so. Like when they cut down on flights and cruise ships, they hit on one of the biggest economic sectors on Cuba, which is tourism, which employed a lot of people that lost their jobs because of those sanctions. Back in 2019, for a while, Cuba, we were deeply affected when it came to transportation because the United States prevented oil from coming into the country. Those are just three examples. I could go on because there's actually, and sadly, a lot of them.
Just to give a little bit of background to the differences between Obama's kind of pivot towards Cuba towards the end of his presidency versus Biden, can you talk about what that looked like? I know it didn't last for very long, but it did have an impact, right?
Yes, it certainly did. Basically, at the end of his second term, Barack Obama chose to depart from the traditional way in which U.S. and Cuba relations had played out for a lot of time. He did so because the traditional way, which was one of aggression, of not negotiation, of sanctions, had not worked. So he changed that. He re-engaged in relations, and that was very beneficial both for Cubans and Americans in many ways. Now, when Donald Trump came in, he completely rolled back on this. But not only that, he also imposed a lot of new sanctions against Cuba that affected us here very much. Now, Biden, we in Cuba were actually very hopeful that he would return to the Obama approach, having been Obama's vice president back then, and because of some announcements he did during his campaign. Sadly, in the time that he has been in office, he has done nothing to return to that approach. And he has basically left in place each of the sanctions that Trump applied during his term. So right now in Cuba, even though Biden is president, it is exactly the same for us as if Trump had never left office. And Trump was the worst presidency for the Cuban people in terms of sanctions.
So I grew up in South, I was born in Latin America, but I grew up in South Florida. And, you know, growing up, I mean, Florida has always played an important role in U.S. elections. Every 4 years, it becomes very annoying to consume media in the state of Florida because you're just constantly bombarded with political ads. And so I'm curious, like, in your opinion, in your perspective, why do you think there was that shift between what are two presidential candidates from the Democratic Party?
The very significant expat community of Cuban Americans in Florida plays a very important role in elections, like you said, because Florida is a swing state with a very leveled Republican and Democratic population. And then the Cuban American significant population then plays a significant role. That's it. But then the problem is a lot of this expat community, the initial group of it that migrated in the 60s as a result of the Cuban Revolution, understandably have significant differences with the Cuban government. And these political differences have been exploited for years. Now, the myth has been in place for a long time that unless you have a tough on Cuba stand as a politician, you cannot win this Cuban American community. Now, I would say that in some cases, this has been true. However, when Barack Obama applied his different approach of re-engagement with Cuba, the Florida International University's poll on Cuban Americans in Florida that they conduct yearly actually showed that for the first time, the majority of those polled, of those Cuban Americans, opposed the embargo, opposed the sanctions. Now, what that tells me is that leadership matters. The position that the leaders of the community and that politicians assume in terms of U.S.-Cuba politics actually defines what people feel and believe about this. Because in many cases, the stand of Cuban Americans in Florida is more sentimental than rational.
I just want to add, I was in Miami when Obama announced he was going to open up relations with Cuba. And for the most part, people were generally on board. I mean, I work with a lot of Cubans and, you know, their attitude, at least this is anecdotal, of course, but their attitude was, OK, it wasn't working. So let's try something new. So I could personally attest to that. But let me ask, who, in your perspective, who is to blame for the continued embargo? Is it that small but very vocal minority of the Cuban expat community?
In part, yes. But to leave it at yes would actually be unfair to them. You have to understand that whichever the end game, the result for those in Cuba is, I can understand why many people in Florida feel the way they feel about the Cuban government and about all of this. Yeah. The problem is, I think there are politicians that I feel are more to blame than that community because they actually know better. The politicians that profit from this relationship of hatred know better. They know how it works and don't care. And I'm talking, I don't know, about people like Marco Rubio, about people like Bob Menendez. These are people that directly profit from this, that know that the things they say are lies and don't care. So I think at this point in time, I would put the blame more on them than I would put it on the expat community as a whole, at least the part that opposes engagement or opposes a different approach. And of course, the national campaigns, whichever president that decides to play the game instead of trying to break the myth like Obama did is also responsible.
So related to that and trying to maybe convey a message out of Cuba that most people in the United States don't often receive, can you just talk a little bit about what you've produced about Belly of the Beast?
Yes. Belly of the Beast is a American-based media that is composed of American and Cuban journalists. And we cover Cuba-United States relations. We try to do so by showing the reality of the Cuban people. We want to expose the fact that United States politics, United States sanctions have a direct effect on the people in Cuba. And that needs to be shown. And that's basically what we have based all our work around. We had a 3-episode first part of the war in Cuba, and we're producing a second part of 3 episodes again. We focused on the Trump policies for the first time around, and we're focusing on Biden for this second delivery.
Okay, excellent. And then where can people watch that?
Well, Belly of the Beast is on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. We release all of our content directly on social media. Belly of the Beast Cuba is the way to find it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Denya.
No, thank you, Luisa.
Sabes, tu retórica ya me aburrió. Yo no sé a qué masa le vas a mentir. Otra vez, mi pueblo que se unió te enfrenta y te dice que bloqueo no. Tratas de ponernos contra la pared. Te da rabia no podernos someter. Otra vez, mi fe te sorprendió y el mundo te grita que bloqueo no. Coge mambo, coge timba y no comas tanta guinda al brindar con tus cipayos y otros tontos papagayos.
The song you just heard is called Desbo Kiami, which literally translates as Unblock Me, but a more literary translation might be End the Blockade. The song is by Raul Torres. This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now we conclude our program today with another segment in our Left on the Law series. A panel of criminal and environmental lawyers from around the world has created a legal definition for ecocide on the basis of a push to criminalize mass damage and destruction of ecosystems. In this Left in the Law segment, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker discussed this campaign and the potential political use of the International Criminal Court to pursue major polluters and destroyers of the planet.
In the program of events for the 26th Conference of the Parties under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP26, there was a series of speakers and workshops on the Stop Ecocide campaign to criminalize actions by companies primarily that destroy the environment. Well, Mike, before we take up that campaign and the legal strategy of this Stop Ecocide work, let's start with some of the cases here in the United States that we talked about in our last Left in the Law segment. We talked about the Minnesota case and some of the civil suits brought by cities and jurisdictions around the country against oil companies. Let's start with the Minnesota case.
The Minnesota case is becoming the lead dog. It's been very competently put together by Keith Ellison, the guy who prosecuted the killers of George Floyd. It is now pending before the Eighth Circuit.
Will you say what the case is?
Well, the case is called Minnesota versus American Petroleum Institute. And for people who are really curious, there is a webpage called climatecasechart.com, all lowercase, that has a complete record of cases suing fossil fuel companies all over the world.
There are a lot of them, too.
There's lots of them, and they also feature copies of the actual briefs, the complaints made. And in the Minnesota case, there's a remarkable series of amicus briefs that have been filed that lays out really the state of the art right now about litigating against fossil fuel companies. You know, originally, the first people who sued them because they were despoiling the air and the water. But those cases generally lost because, as the lead Second Circuit case ruled against the city of New York, well, all these things are legal. The finding of gasoline, processing it, selling it, it's entirely legal. And that sort of was that until the remarkable finding of information beginning in 2015 with the Columbia School of Journalism and different investigators found that the fossil fuel companies had lied, just like the tobacco companies had lied. And they knew, in fact, decades ago that climate change was very real, that it was man-made, and their own actions were making it. They even not only knew this as reported by papers, but they made their investment choices on the inevitability of climate change. they actually allocated resources based on the anticipating seas rising and other inevitable changes that they were meanwhile saying weren't real or were all a confusing mess of uncertainty.
Now, Mike, it may seem obvious, but in a sense it's not, in that many of us are used to political players and companies lying. Advertising has a wide latitude for deception. Why is this question of deception so important in going forward with these civil suits against oil companies?
Well, it makes oil companies' behavior illegal instead of legal.
What's illegal here?
The deception. The fact you can't, it's like a business. If you promise that using this will make your teeth white when you know that it will actually make your teeth fall out, well, that's illegal.
Even though it's widely practiced, but there's a pretty high threshold for establishing this, right? Wasn't the one issue that their own research had confirmed the very proclamations of climate activists for decades and scientists, and that they were even acting to contradict their own research findings? And so this issue of intentionality to deceive is what's at stake here.
Yeah, intent is always a huge concept in the law. In criminal law, if you kill somebody, you can get anything from death penalty to release the next day, depending on your state of mind. You know, if it was a reasonable self-defense, you can walk. If it was unreasonable self-defense, or if you thought there was a danger around, your subjective feeling about it, all the way up to deliberate and premeditated killing, determines your penalty. And so too in the law. For example, Minnesota sued them in an effort to avoid federal court strictly on Minnesota statutes of consumer protection, saying you cannot knowingly deceive consumers. And there's three or four laws that they relied on, and they alleged as proof that the defendants had actual knowledge of the risks associated with their fossil fuel products, but didn't say anything about it.
I assume that part of the case requires you to establish the consequences of the deception. So not having your teeth white is one thing, having them fall out another, using your example. And I think that's always true in lawsuits, right? That you have to show damages of a significant nature.
Well, the damage problem is never the problem here. I mean, the damages, the evidence mounts every day, every hour, of all the damages caused by increasing atmospheric CO2 concentrations. The effects are catastrophic. The problem has been linking up behavior of fossil fuel companies to that damage. And their defense historically has been, well, maybe, you know, it's true, these are bad things, but we're just making gas and selling it. That's a completely legitimate, entirely legal process. We're protected by 100 laws. It's something that people want us to do. We had no bad faith in any of our actions.
And they've also depended very heavily, and I think the social sciences have to some extent been complicit in this, a broad diffusion of responsibility that, well, we all share in this, we all contribute to the problem, no one actor is responsible. So these suits kind of run counter to that notion of we're all equally responsible.
Well, yeah, the defendants, they develop very sophisticated public relations strategies to deny the risks of climate change, to diffuse them among all of us. And who doesn't want to be able to drive to the hospital if their loved one is sick, or go enjoy themselves in another neighborhood by driving? And also to create a doubt about the scientific consensus of global warming. Like, is it a real thing? And how does it happen if it even is a real thing? And just make everything kind of up in the air. Maybe so, maybe not. Create ambiguities, doubts, and diffuse responsibilities. It's been a conscious, deliberate, and well-funded effort done for decades.
You know, Mike, you mentioned the parallels with big tobacco, but I'd like you to comment a bit on a more recent parallel with big pharma. And this maybe is a segue into some of the criminal cases with ecocide. with the Sackler family, and of course these were civil suits, but it's also been the possibilities raised around criminal suits against pharmaceutical companies with the deaths of people through prescription practices that the Sackler family knew opioids were contributing to high rates of addiction and deaths. How do you see the parallel of that with the opioid crisis and big pharma?
Well, there's a parallel and also a very big difference. The parallel is that human beings are completely unpredictable as individuals, but we are utterly predictable in large numbers. If we're just in that way like atoms, you know, scientists can look at a ball of radium and say with certainty that half of this will be gone in 10,000 years, but they have no idea which half will be gone. And so we don't know what any individual is going to do in his or her life, but we do know pretty exactly what will happen on a large scale. That's why insurance companies make money. They can predict, and they do predict very accurately. And the Sackler family knew very well that their products would result in large levels of addiction and death, and they proceeded anyway. Now, they defend themselves by saying this is always an individual choice. Each separate person is either weak enough or needy enough to become addicted, and it's an individual problem. It's a spiritual problem. But that is, on one level, very true. But it's also very predictable that a certain percentage of people who will become addicted to these opioids and will give up everything else in life in order to keep those opioids coming, and that they will eventually die as a result. And they proceeded with the same advertising policies with full knowledge that this would be the result on a large scale.
I think part of what's interesting about all of these campaigns against big tobacco and big oil and also big pharma is how much class politics end up kind of shaping the moral discourse around it. So tobacco moved from a signifier of women's liberation and independence to being associated with poor people. It was very much lost status and glamour, for sure. You can't see smoking anymore in a lot of movies. You know, it's banned. And if people smoke, they need to be punished by the story. I think with oil, there may be that aspect to it in terms of who can afford an electric car. And with the opioid crisis, it was interesting how many rural white people became addicted and died from opioid overdoses, which for a long time had been framed as a problem of people who were degenerate losers, you know, lowlifers, you know, these
white
stereotypes of addicts. So it's kind of gained moral authority as it's moved away from oppressed people to more everyday people, although it's still, I think, more often, you know, a problem of poor and the dispossessed. But how about this, the criminal, is there anything you'd want to add to that with parallels?
Yeah, there's the ways in which fossil fuels, opioids, and big tobacco are all the same, and that they did not get called to the carpet and really closely looked at until it was shown that they were liars. Like the tobacco companies had a critical hearing before Congress where it turned out they knew for decades that smoking cigarettes would cause lung cancer, and they did nothing about it. They tried to obscure this fact. They tried to create doubt. They tried to blame individuals. They did all the rhetorical and all the public relations things that fossil fuel companies are now doing,
which has a strong ideological grounding, especially in capitalist societies and particularly perhaps the U.S., individualizing problems.
Yeah. And then fossil fuel companies, of course, are doing the same. They're saying, trying to make it the use of oil and gas is something that's individual. So actually, they're in their sights now and are suffering and are having to increase their budgets for defending against these cases and ultimately having to pay because they were caught lying. They were caught not only lying, but spending their money in the basis of the fact that they were liars.
Let's turn to the Stop Ecocide campaign and the foundation based in Yale that brought together an international panel of environmental lawyers and activists, scientists, working to make environmental damage carried out intentionally by corporate, to some extent, governmental actors, a crime that is now, the term ecocide, which has been around for quite a while, is gathering momentum as a campaign. Can you explain the legal definition of ecocide and how that's being advanced through the international criminal courts?
Sure. You know, unlike suing and fining corporations who simply budget for this possibility, making ecocide a crime will create an arrestable offense. So there are serious movements led by one group called Stop Ecocide International, or Stop Ecocide on the Earth, that's trying to make it a crime and under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, which now lists four crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of aggression, recently added. And this, what they want to do is amend the statute to add a fifth crime of ecocide. The definition is basically a destruction of the natural world, and make that as akin to, and even a variation on, killing off people.
So what are the precedents that are used to build the case and address issues around standing and the criteria that are pretty high for using some of the statutes that were established after World War II, right, or around 1945?
Yeah.
Genocide. Can you list some of those criteria and how they relate to this new crime?
Well, what they want to do is first get any state which is ratified or officially agreed to the ICC can propose an amendment. There's like 123 now of these states' parties are called. And as soon as any state or a group of states submits a proposal, then people will start to see changes in the way corporations behave. Like investors, bankers, insurers, people like that will start to avoid dangerous investments because they know a law is coming within a few years, which is a valuable time period there because that would allow businesses to change their practices.
So you're speaking to partly the gap between the challenges in achieving this change in a statute, the high bar, plus how difficult it is to get convictions. There's been, a handful of them over the decades? So,
well, yeah, if they succeed, the process, the way these people are approaching it, I think is good. They're not expecting to have a statute on the books immediately, and they think that's not even necessarily what they want to do. They want to give all these corporations a chance to make significant changes. Then, after they get it proposed by one of these 123 people, you need what's called admissibility. It requires a majority of the people who have signed on to agree that the amendment can be considered.
Now, who are these signers?
123 countries, every country you've heard of, the U.S., all the European countries, most African countries, most Asian countries.
They have a designated representative or signer, signatory.
Yeah, 123 separate states have signed on and are using the International Criminal Court. So that's quite a few. And if it's finally adopted into the statute, that requires a two-thirds majority of the states. But once the law is adopted, the crime then exists, even if it's not yet enforceable. Harming nature will begin to feel the same as harming human beings is the idea. It's a crime to do that.
So there's a kind of political, rhetorical aspect of this that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in a profound way, which is really where we live. You know, it's the thing called public opinion is very nebulous, but it's enormously powerful. And finally, they would want to get ratification by the states. If the states ratify it, that is officially submit their agreement, they have to enforce the law in their own country 1 year later. And once the more countries that ratify it, then you can sue in your country for any action a big polluter does anywhere in the world. You don't need to have them offending you on your own home ground. So it becomes a criminal offense in these countries under universal jurisdiction principles. Any ratifying nation can anywhere on its own soil arrest somebody who's not even from that country.
Much better than that stupid Texas abortion law.
Much, much better.
Okay, Mike. Well, we'll have to follow this. It's interesting, particularly as it gets taken up around kind of the moral arguments in the climate movement and political organizing.
There are problems, too, about the International Criminal Court, but we're a long way from facing those. So yeah. I think this whole process of proposing it, of having it be considered as a crime, is going to start having an immediate effect all the way through to ratification. There will be significant changes made just by that process before there are any real criminal prosecutions.
Okay, so, well, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker today talking about lawsuits and criminal suits against oil companies suing their pants off, and now hopefully their pants are on fire as the planet itself is at risk of continuing to be on fire. So at any rate, it would be good to continue to follow this campaign to stop ecocide and also some of the civil cases here in the U.S. as well as they go forward on the legal front of the climate movement. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Jen.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. A big thanks to John Nelson, who produced today's program. Also, thanks to all of our Old Mole regulars and their guests, Bill Resnick and Dave Anderson, on the ongoing battle between fossil fuels and renewable energy. Luisa Martinez and her guest, Daniel Montero, for their discussion of the Cuban blockade. And our Left in the Law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, for their report on the campaign to toughen the laws regarding wanton pollution of the environment due to human activity. Thanks all. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. This is KBOO Portland.